So this workshop today is about famine. And it's about the mitzvah of laket. It is about a paradigm change for how we look at church and how we look at ourselves as the body of Christ within this world that is struggling with a famine of the soul, a famine of hope. This workshop today is not meant to be about awareness. One of the things that I have agreed to with those that work with me, I work along with on the Anti-Trafficking Task Force for the World Evangelical Alliance, is that we will not do workshops that just promote awareness, because all of us now, I think, are aware at some level. And awareness is good to an extent, but we have to work past awareness. And so this workshop today is about the practicalities of how. But it's not a step-by-step guide. It's not a program. I'm not going to give you a packet that you can leave with and say, this is how, on Monday, I can start to reach and impact this issue of slavery. It's not that either. If you want statistics, I can give you one. 28 to 32 million people today are estimated to be enslaved in some kind of slavery. Those are estimates because we have quite a large difficulty with even trying to understand exactly how many people are. It's such a transient issue. Not to mention that for our part of the world, we're responsible. We live in Hungary, but we're responsible for Central Europe, which includes Scandinavian countries, but also the Balkan Peninsula. And so within that spectrum for us, we have Roma, Gypsy peoples, who cannot even be counted. And yet we know that within that ethnic group, a plethora of people are being trafficked. 78%, when we talk about human trafficking, 78% of the people that are trafficked for sexual exploitation. Around 14% right now are trafficked for illegal or forced labor. When we hear the word trafficking, we tend to think sexual exploitation, and perhaps rightly so. But the statistics are now showing that the fastest growing area is actually in the area of forced labor. And that encompasses children, men and women, and even men into their middle ages. And we'll talk a little bit later about why that might be. Let me give you a picture. I won't tell a lot of stories today. I won't tell a lot of stories because I'm careful about the stories that I tell because of the dignity that is involved in telling somebody else's story. But I will carefully tell you a couple. I want to give you a picture. One of the countries where we live and work, where we work, not where we live, is Kosovo. So if you know anything, if you remember a history of a decade or so ago, you know that the Serbs, which is an Orthodox country, there was this genocide that happened first with Croatia. Thousands of people died, and then they moved into Kosovo, which is a Muslim country. And the destruction that occurred, I mean, the death and the destruction of the infrastructure of the country was horrible. Entire families uprooted, living in the mountains or walking for kilometers for days to get to Albania or Macedonia, entering into this existence as refugees and what that meant. And when they came back, there was literally no infrastructure left, or very little of an infrastructure left. So that would be in the late 1990s. Today, what we have in Kosovo, which is a Muslim country, but a very forward-thinking, very modern, not in the postmodern modern sense, but in the technologically advanced, forward-thinking European idea. We have a culture that is very able to compete in a European market in terms of education and abilities. But because of their location, because of the political reality of Europe, specifically focused on Kosovo, there is a poverty, a famine of opportunity, and a famine of choice. 2 months ago, 2 to 3 months ago, across Europe, the media was focused on the fact that thousands, and I mean thousands of Kosovar, young Kosovars, predominantly young men, were loading buses. They couldn't keep the buses running fast enough. They were filling bus after bus after bus, and the buses were all leaving and heading to Germany because Germany has relatively porous borders. And these young men were headed to Germany knowing that they were going to enter the country illegally in search of work, because as a collective society, generations live together, support one another, work together, and somebody has to make a living. Somebody has to provide. And so the young men were leaving Kosovo, intentionally becoming illegal immigrants, illegal migrants, intentionally entering into situations where, for all intents and purposes, they become part of a forced labor or an illegal labor market simply because there are no other opportunities and there are no other options. So when we talk about forced labor, illegal labor, this is part of what we're talking about and the growth. I could talk about social orphans, I won't right now, but it is something that you can put down in your little notes and watch for. It's a phenomenon that we will be seeing and will be talked about in the future. We are, I think, on the cusp as a global community, on the cusp of dealing with what that means and what global orphans, social orphans, are going to mean to us and the difficulty that we're going to have with that demographic of young people. I'll tell you today, just to give you an extra idea, that if you want to talk about sexual exploitation and that market, that right now the hottest human commodity on the human market is a pregnant woman. Why? Three reasons. Number one, there are men who have fetishes for pregnant women and they'll pay more. Number two, when a woman has a child, she is easier to control. And number three, there's a baby market. Illegal adoption. Men who have fetishes for babies. And as hard and as difficult as this is to say, there is a market in some places in Asia especially where babies are on the menu. So when we talk about trafficking, we're talking about sexual exploitation, we're talking about begging, we're talking about illegal labor or forced labor, illegal adoptions, organ harvesting, maternity trafficking, forced surrogacy. And by that I mean actual farms where women are impregnated, produce a child, re-impregnated, produce a child. Because you see, this is the phenomena for trafficking, human trafficking, the slavery market. It is a very lucrative business. This is about an economic decision. The drug industry, illegal drug industry, right now still brings in a higher income. But I think we can look to the future and expect that the human trafficking market may supersede the illegal drug trafficking market. And let me explain to you why. If I produce marijuana or whatever, there is a sense in which I have to purchase something in order to to grow it. There is some kind of an economic investment that I make. And once I take that to market and I sell it, that product is done. Not so with a human crop. Not so with a human product. It is relatively easy and cheap to sustain a human life, especially if that human life has already is giving life to another life. And the human product can be used and reused and reused and reused and reused and reused until it simply gives out. It's a very, very lucrative business. When we talk about trafficking, when we talk about countries of origin, that's where we grow the product, right? That is the earth out of which people are born, their culture, their passport country or culture. We have countries of transit. Those are the countries in which the product is moved. And we'll talk about how that happens, but the product is moved from origin through countries of transit to destination countries. And destination countries then would be the consumers, the countries that create and drive the demand for the product. Where I live, most of the countries that where we work, the Balkan Peninsula, Southeastern Europe, are countries of origin, countries of transit, and countries of destination. Scandinavian countries, also part of our field. Wealthier, westernized countries, countries of destination. America, the US, North America, always a country of destination. Not to say that at some points we don't function as a country of origin, but the market, the product is best sold. The demand is high in North America. If I could take a metaphor and expand it a little bit for you, We understand that in the area of realm of prostitution, we understand that we have a prostitute, a woman who sells her body. We understand that that woman is controlled and marketed by a pimp who is actually usually a middleman, middle person, for that business. And we have a John, usually a man, although doesn't have to be a man, who buys the product, buys the services of the product. The John creates the demand. If the men or women who were buying the product no longer were willing to buy the product, then it would no longer be a lucrative business. That's why Sweden, interestingly enough, Sweden is now choosing to target the men who buy prostitution. And they are one country where we see the decrease in trafficking because they're cutting the demand. So in a very real sense, although it's difficult to say, I think that we could take that idea and apply it a little bit larger and say that in some way America functions as a very, very, very dependable John. We continue to create demand. We'll talk about that in a minute. Up somewhere, as this files through, you'll see a slide that say Western cultures. That would be us, American culture, North American culture, Western cultures, wealthy Western cultures, sell a dream that makes other cultures vulnerable. You see, because of the global interconnectedness that we have. The cultures where I live and work are very, very, very well schooled in the American dream. And to be quite honest, they also have master's degrees. They also have the capability to make a living if there was not this famine of opportunity. And what they see that the West has creates and fuels a dream within them to have the same thing, which lends itself to a very, very honest conversation then about our responsibility as Western cultures for our choices about consumption, lifestyle, those kinds of things. Sometimes in the church I hear this conversation about whether we should be talking about social justice or whether we should be talking about spirituality or theology or even holiness, and kind of this pulling at the two ends. And if there's anything that you leave with today, I hope that you leave at least thinking about this idea that social justice and this issue of trafficking, it's an issue for all of us. Most importantly, it's a spiritual issue. It is a social issue, it is an economic issue, it is a government issue, but it is more than that. It is a spiritual issue. Because the drive toward materialism fuels the trafficking, the slavery machine. So the people in our pews, they're wrestling with the sins of gluttony, greed, and lust. And let me just be honest here. Lust and greed, basically the same thing. You just attach to lust a sexual aspect. But greed and lust, and these sins materialize in the form of a sexual industry and illegal labor, and they exist because there is a demand, and the demand exists because there's sin. So in order to deal with the demand, we have to deal with the sin. Whenever you add gluttony, lust, greed to pleasure, you get addiction. And I would dare to ask if, as an American culture, as a North American culture, as wealthy Western cultures, now I'm expanding into Europe, whether we have a problem with addiction. I have a friend who runs a safe house in Budapest. She's a Hungarian lady. Her name's Ildikó. And I met with Ildikó to explore whether or not there's something that I could do as an English teacher to help with the girls that she ministers to in the safe house. These are prostituted Hungarian women. And she said to me, yeah, of course, I'd love for you to come and be a part. We've talked about maybe bringing volunteers to help us in that area. And she said to me, but here's the deal. Every volunteer that I take, I have to say this too. Our girls are addicted. Every one of them are addicted to something. Some of them to more than one thing, but some of them to drugs, some of them to sex, some of them to pornography. They're all addicted to something, and we know that, and we embrace that. And when they come into the house, one of the things that they have to do, they have to go through a 12-step program to deal with those addictions, to bring them out into the light and to talk about them and to discuss them and to let God heal them. And then she said to me, but Tiana, every volunteer that comes into the house has to go through the 12-step program too. We as a church, traditionally, I think, have wanted to be the provider, the one that carries help. And always, I mean, it's beautiful that we want to help people. It's right that we want to help people. But we have to understand that there is a paradigm attached to us just simply carrying in help. You see, it's always a control, a relationship, if you can call it a relationship, of control. I have the power, and I bring to you, but I have the power. I have the resources. I have the knowledge. And the relationship that we have is never a true relationship, an even relationship, an equal relationship. And this is relationship. This is the relationship that God offers us, yes? But for so long, we've been wanting to come and to preserve that relationship of control. And what Ildiko was saying to me was, if you really want to serve, if you really want to make a difference, if you really want to help us break this cycle, you have to step down from your pedestal. You have to recognize your own issues. Be willing to deal with them honestly and authentically. Talk about your addictions. And in that healthy picture of relationship, out of that healthy picture of vulnerability, then we can talk about ministry. Okay, I want to throw a couple more statistics at you, and then move into a little bit of that. So what do we do? What do we do? Frame the problem a little bit more and then talk about what do we do? What does it mean for us as an American church? And I think I've said it already, but I'm going to say it again. It means a complete paradigm shift for us as the American church, and we'll look at what that means. But I would say, not my words actually, words that come out of conferences and conversations that I've had the privilege of being a part of, that we have a global pandemic of dehumanization on our hands. So this issue, we tend to think that trafficking, modern day slavery, this whole thing is just kind of a problem. And I would say to you, consider the possibility that this is not a problem, but this is the problem. Carla talked about the loss of the image of God. And when we begin to see people, not as someone made in the image of God, but when we begin to see people as a product to be used, and dare I say that even as a church culture in how we count numbers, people in our pews, not on the same level, of course, but yet, we have a problem with dehumanizing people and seeing them as a means to an end for our own consumption. ...75% of women entering the prostitution profession entered as children. 90% of prostitutes work involuntarily. 70% are physically forced, beaten to prostitute by their lover boys, by their husbands. In Amsterdam alone, where it's legal to provide the services of a prostitute, thousands of women are raped every night because they didn't make that choice out of freedom. They made that choice, if they made the choice, out out of a reality of famine, of opportunity, of other choices available. And oftentimes, those choices are propagated by a dream that all of us share, to live a life of comfort and safety and happiness and well-being. So what do we do? You know, 21 years ago, well, not all, well, yeah, you're, yeah. I was going to say 21 years ago, you sent me to the mission field, but that's actually not true, because I'm looking at Josh, I'm thinking, yeah, Josh didn't have anything to do with that. But 21 years ago, we ended up, and nor did Hannah, nor did they. But anyway, Caleb, maybe. We ended up on the mission field, and you know, when you send a missionary to the mission field, what do you expect? You expect that I arrive at that country, we know that I don't speak the language, we don't know that I don't know anything, we know that I don't know anything about the culture, I have no idea how to live. I mean, you can ask Carla when they ended up in Moscow in 92, and I can tell you the same story in 94. Figuring out how to buy a loaf of bread was a major activity. And so when you send a missionary into a culture, into a foreign culture, you expect that I will exegete that culture. You expect that I will figure out how to speak the language, how to survive, how to live within that culture. Not as an American, but that I will figure out how to do things like a Hungarian does them. And if you send a missionary into a culture and they don't figure that out, you better demand that they just come right on back home, because they're not doing their job. Now, we understand that when we send a missionary into another culture, that that is the expectation. And you did that, didn't you, Josh, when you guys lived in Bulgaria? And they did it well. I mean, everybody loved Josh. They wanted him to stay. They were angry with us when they left, actually, because he exegeted the culture very well. The funny thing is that we here in America assume that because we are Americans living with Americans amongst people who speak the same language that we do, and call themselves Americans as well, that we no longer need to exegete the culture. But in fact, we do. We need to learn what it means to live, what it means to be a person outside of the church walls. How do they act? What do they eat? How do they speak? What do they value? Why do they value it? You know, I'm walking down the street in Moscow, and I've got a sweet little baby girl in my arms, and it's December, and it's cold, and I'm carrying this sweet girl. I've got her there, and she's all wrapped up nice and warm, and she's fast asleep, and it's a beautiful thing. And as I'm walking along with my baby here in a bag here, because I couldn't take my buggy with me because it didn't fit on the, anyway. So here I am with Lexi, here I am with my bag, and I'm not adding to the story. A little grandma, a little baba, babushka, marches right up to me, takes that sweet little baby out of my arms. Absolutely never seen this grandma before and never saw her again. Takes that baby out of my arms, unwraps her, and as she's doing it, she says to me, "You don't know how to really wrap up the baby. We here in Russia, we have really cold winters, and there's a way that you do that." Unwraps the baby. Now she's crying and screaming because she's been rudely awakened from her sleep. Wraps her back up so that she can't move. And then hands her back to me. And now I have a well-wrapped, screaming baby in my arms. Now, very honestly, culturally, as an American, get your hands off my baby. But as someone who had to exegete the culture, I understand that in Russia it takes a village to raise a child. And that was an act of love. That was an act of love by that grandma. We need to learn how to exegete our culture. Theologically, I think we need to understand that God is missional, that the very character and nature of God is a missional God. God is on mission, has always been, from our Genesis story to Revelation. God is a missional God. That is a very core aspect of who God is. And if you want to learn more about what it means, how that's kind of unwrapped, there's a wonderful missiologist from Australia named Michael Frost. You can Google him. You can listen to him preach. He's amazing. God is missional. And now I want to talk to you about networks. I want to move into, what do we do? Lexi, this sweet Lexi, for her senior, project, did a presentation on Bulgaria and the issue of prostitution trafficking. Lex, can you just explain? I'm going to throw up these two maps. Can you explain to us what you discovered? Now, this is just Bulgaria, but the concept applies globally.
So I limited my senior thesis to just Bulgaria because I focused on sex trafficking in Bulgaria because it's such a large issue that even just tackling one country is a huge deal. Keep it on the map.
Yeah, I do.
So as I was pulling research, I talked to several people from several different denominations, all people that I knew and grew up with, and all people who are working with trafficking victims, both, and I asked them, as I was talking to them, they all said the same thing, and they said there's a network of traffickers. And you can actually map those people that are sent from areas in Bulgaria to specific countries. So I made this map, go back to the Bulgarian one. This is Bulgaria right here with the different provinces. And you can see the different colors and how they relate to countries in Europe. You've got people from the Sofia area going to Spain and Switzerland, I think. Switzerland, Austria, Italy, and Spain. You got people from the north going to France. You got people from the middle, Mid East going to Germany, and then the people from the Mid South going to Germany as well. And you can track it, and it's because in the 90s when the wall fell and the borders opened relatively, and traffic was allowed through Europe, people made connections, whether it was through human trafficking or even just crime rings, and they had a process, and now it's no longer unorganized and chaos. It's a structure, and that's why you have girls going from Sofia to Spain, because that's the path that they've made, and it's the path that works well.
Good, very good. And that would be true all over Europe and actually on a global scale. So you have well-routed, well-documented, well-understood, well-oiled pathways that move the product, the human cargo, the human product, from country of origin to country of destination. And those pathways are made up of individual tiny little links of people, seemingly inconsequential people. It works like this. For example, Lexi talked about Bulgaria, one of the areas where we have a growing church, but within that structure there, we have a lot of mountain villages. And so Gypsy people, Roma people, who have a poverty, a famine of choice on a huge scale. So they know what the West is, they know the kind of choices, the kind of life that we lead, and there is absolutely no possibility that they could ever attain anything close to. I mean, these people make a choice between whether we're going to eat, whether we're going to have medication, or whether we're going to have heat. You can pick one. Two, maybe, if you're lucky. This zone is the place where the majority of girls who are prostituted actually get pulled from. And so the narrative goes like this. Remember, this is one tiny little link. So we have a lady in one of those villages who is called to preach. She's found the Lord. Her name is Petra. And she's actually in our course of study. Petra has one son named Bobby, and she has a husband named Stoiko. They live a very impoverished reality. and they live up in the mountains. You have to walk several kilometers to even get anywhere there, even in the winter time. Bobby goes to school. It's a huge sacrifice for the family for him to be able to do that. They don't have a car. And so somebody comes to Stoico, who is a man, a father in his 40s, who cannot provide for his family. They say, I have a car. Stoico, brother, I know your family would do well with a car. I give you my car. No problem. You can have my car. And I know you need to eat, and the family's hungry sometimes. A little bit of money. I just need a favor. Sometimes I need to take somebody to the airport in Sofia. It's an hour drive. I give you my car. I give you some money to make the drive. And you just drive to the airport. That's it. That's all you do. Stoico is not breaking any laws. He's not done anything wrong. He's just making money for his family. Individual little links of people within a well-oiled network that is globally connected. You see, we think that the people that run the prostitution or the slavery markets, we think that they're stupid, oily-haired, pimple-faced adults with an eighth-grade education. But the human trafficking business is incredibly lucrative. And they are organized, they are adaptable, they are highly resourced, they are illicit trade networks, they are a 30-plus billion-dollar-a-year enterprise. And they have a long-term focus for how to expand. So a network, by definition, is the structure of a backbone. It's the center point of logistics. It is a group that is intentionally formed together for a common vision and goal. It creates a professional accountability framework. It is part of a bigger whole, and it is able to shift. Listen to this. It is able to shift with the changes that need to happen or are happening in the market. The human slavery animal is a network of like-minded, intentional, highly invested Fortune 500 businessmen and women who know how to do business and make a profit. Because trafficking is actually only about the economics. We think it's about sex. It's not about sex. It's about the economics. In November, I had a man in my home. He's of Korean descent. His name's An. He is a Nazarene. He ended up going to Kyiv, Ukraine, as a Nazarene in volunteer service. He met a young woman there, a Nazarene young woman there, and they got married. And then he ended up, because of his job, the job that he got, they ended up moving to Austria together. He works for a secular governmental organization that focuses on international migration. And they actually work with the EU. They're part of the EU, European Union, but they disconnect themselves to some extent from the European Union so that they can work specifically with countries that are not yet part of the European Union to look at migration, the issue of migration, and to help those countries that are not part of the EU think creatively about this issue of illegal migration. So he works within the secular world. And he was sitting in our home in Budapest in November after a nice Thanksgiving meal, and we began to talk about his job. And he said, governments, they have the resources to fight this issue. If it's money or resources that you need, we've got enough. And NGOs, there are NGOs all over the place that are able to do programs to address this issue. You see, we have a global pandemic, right? A global pandemic. And we've got money, and we've got the vaccine. He said, but what we don't have a delivery system. We don't have a way to get the medicine to the people who are sick. If only there was an organism that was present in every community across our globe. If only there was an organism that had the ability to touch people in their face-to-face, hands-on, every day, going to the grocery store, living out their lives in a house, sending their kids to school. If only there was an organism that was at the grassroots level present in every community across the globe. Well, then we could break the cycle. In April, Hannah and I were in Bucharest at a conference for trafficking that was hosted by the European Freedom Network. You know what I left thinking? Hannah, I think, did too. I think, are you ordained? Not yet, but you're on your way. 200 plus NGOs at that conference, Christian, non-Christian, mostly Christian. I was one of the only ordained people at that conference. If only we had an organism at the grassroots level that could deliver the medicine. You see, it takes a network to take down a network. And that's where the paradigm shift comes. Just what Kathy, I think, was talking about. To see our neighborhood as a parish. To understand that we exist in this place for these people where we do life, and that they are our parish. They are our responsibility. And if we could begin to think as a network, which, what does that require? That requires for us to let go of things like, well, how many people, if I do this, how many people are going to come into my church? If I put this amount of money towards this project, what is the profit in terms of people in my pews on Sunday morning? If we can let go of that paradigm and we can begin to look at our neighborhood as a parish and say, and this is radical hospitality, these people are my church. This place is my responsibility. Hospitality, radical hospitality says, I am responsible for the well-being, no matter what that means. I am responsible because God placed me here. I am responsible for the well-being of these people in this place. Well, then we begin to look at things like vulnerability, famine of opportunity, famine of choice. We begin to look at the structures that create vulnerability, family breakdown, lack of education, lack of employment, poverty, exploitation. These are the things that create vulnerability. And we can say, if we can affect change, if we can affect change in one place, we break the cycle. We don't have to hit it in every place, one place. In very real terms, because our time's almost up. What does that mean? The majority of the men in your pews today are addicted to pornography. And pornography is the entry drug into the sexual exploitation market. The majority of men in your pews today are addicted to pornography. 50% of the women in your pews today are addicted to pornography. Their levels of addiction are rising faster than men's. So we need to have some conversations. Care about what coffee you drink? I asked on. I said, you know, does it make a difference if I actually choose which coffee I drink? Does that actually have a global impact? He said, yes and no. It has a small impact. But you can make choices. You can make choices to connect yourself to the food that you purchase. So you can make a choice to find, to connect yourself, and I can do it for you, to a farmer in Guatemala that is connected to a Nazarene or a Christian industry. And you can choose to buy coffee from that person, because that is a direct connection to a person who is providing for their family. Works for chocolate too. In our churches, because we hear about this issue and we say, what can the little old lady do? See, we ramp up awareness and then, but what can we do practically? How about we learn to recognize vulnerability? How about we learn to make relationships with vulnerable people? The 13-year-old girl without a dad that lives next door to the church, she's vulnerable. Somebody invite her to supper. Somebody invite her mom. Somebody take her into your home on a weekly basis. A grandma in your congregation can do that, and that has direct impact on vulnerability. It has direct impact on the issue. As a church, what if you called a meeting with other churches in your parish? And what if you looked at the people in your pews and said, what is it that we have to offer? Where are our skills? Where is our strength? And how can we impact? How can we offer that? What if we went to officials in our parish and said, you know, here we are, and this is what we can do. No strings attached. No evangelism. No brochures. We're just people taking care of our parish. We're just here to look out for the vulnerable. No strings attached. No manipulation. And what if the Catholic Church and the Baptist Church, what if we would begin to see ourselves as a network of God's people? It takes a network to break a network, right? Well then, that's a paradigm shift that I think has an opportunity to deliver the medicine to a people who are so desperately in need of it. And in the process, I think we will see healing within our churches as well. Can businessmen in your congregation create job opportunities for vulnerable young men and young women? Can they choose to hire people so that there is that famine of choice is somehow helped? Can you meet with politicians and offer to be their advocate for best practice in the area of human trafficking, or incentives for a community to hire vulnerable people? Or what if you have counselors in your congregation that could work with police and crisis responders who deal with the issue of trafficking to help train them and counsel them. The practical application really comes down to your ability, your desire, your intentionality of exegeting the culture where you live and where you exist. Understanding where the needs are, where the vulnerabilities are, understanding what you as a congregation or as an individual have been gifted by God to use in His kingdom, to turn our face from a paradigm, even within the church, that counts people as a product, and begin to envision ourselves as a network that catches people. And I don't mean catches and grabs, but catches as in a net of safety, and creates opportunities to break the cycle of famine, to intentionally step away from being part of the demand and to be part of the answer. Boaz, the kinsman redeemer, meets Ruth, the Moabite. Don't ever marry a Moabite woman. And what does he say to his servants? Do you remember the story? Let this woman glean in my fields. His servants. Let this woman glean in my fields. Leave room at the edges for her. And not only leave room at the edges, but with what you've harvested, pull out a little bit and leave it for her. The new paradigm, a paradigm shift. Leave room at the edges. Leave room at the edges. And the poor will glean. Any thoughts or questions? If you need to leave, feel free to do so.
So, do you have any idea, or is there any statistic of how many slaves, human trafficking is going on in the United States?
Off the top of my head, I don't have that statistic, but it's very easy to find with Google. Very easy to find. But whatever statistic you find, you have to understand that it's a very transient number. This is very difficult. And the definitions are changing, actually, regarding what it means exactly, especially with forced labor or illegal labor, how you define that. It's very, very difficult.
How high is it on the priority list of governments?
I think very high. You have different governments dealing with it in different ways. So you have some countries, I'm talking about in Europe now, who have legalized prostitution. You have governments like Sweden who have made this law that they're going to enforce, and they actually go after the Johns, which has been very, very effective.
Legalized prostitution and illegalized paying.
Right.
So is that a good thing or a bad thing?
Well, I think anytime you legalize, it's an interesting thing, interesting comment. We had a chance to be in the Romanian parliament during the conference, and they were talking about Brussels, which has legalized prostitution. And a representative from Brussels said, and this is a crazy thing, but he said, when you legalize prostitution, it means that the government makes money on prostitution. So my representatives have now made me a pimp. As the state makes money on prostitution, by virtue of the fact that I am part of this entity, we make money on prostituting people. And that is the definition of a pimp. So my country, my state has made me a pimp. So legalizing prostitution, I think, is never, ever, ever a good thing.
And it doesn't lower the amount of traffic.
No, because I think the demand, it's not a problem. The problem is the demand. The problem is the sin that creates consumption. The greed and the lust combined with pleasure. Sexual pleasure or the ability to attain more materials that feeds materialism. I mean, we like to talk about, even within this whole issue of homosexuality, I mean, we like to talk about the sexual part because that's a sin that we can understand it and we can touch it and it makes our blood boil. But the reality is that the sin, whether it's sexual or not, is greed and lust. And the addiction that comes when we gain pleasure from that.
So I'm trying to process everything.
Mm-hmm.
You mentioned that the trafficking for human slavery is kind of the trafficking that's on the rise.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and then you mentioned obviously I've heard that. I guess coffee and coffee
yep.
and chocolate are like the two biggest things that matter as far as like where we're getting it from,
mm-hmm.
kind of thing that make maybe the largest impact and that kind of thing. But I guess what are maybe some more of those areas that you know, or is that what you're referring to when you talk about that sort of area of human trafficking that's on the rise? Is that
right.
the kind of
yeah? I'm talking about sexual exploitation takes right now 78% of
right.
the pie.
Mm-hmm.
About 14% that has to do with illegal labor, which includes things like children who are picking coffee beans in the Ivory Coast. And it's a very complicated thing because actually the income that those families make, though it's pennies, it actually supports their families. So it's a complicated issue. Because if you take that money away, what does the family do? What does the family do for food? So we have this mess, if I can put it that way, in which we have to be able to look at cultures and look at the bigger picture. And one of the ways that we can do that, so coffee, chocolate, clothes, the video,
yeah.
right? Because you're meant to understand that the majority of those people that created her clothes, that stitched them and put them together or grew the cotton, all of those people are in forced labor situations because there is a famine of opportunity and choice. It is their only choice.
Are people being to your knowledge, is there human trafficking involved in getting people to those kind of sweatshops and that kind of thing? Like, or is it just more like, they're already there, kind of thing, and this is just the lack of choice you're talking about.
Yeah.
Well,
when you talk about trafficking, it means a movement of individuals, right?
Mm-hmm.
So you have sweatshops
mm-hmm.
that exist in places, but you also have the movement of individuals from poorer neighborhoods, poorer countries, poorer situations into a place, usually across a border, into a place where they are very vulnerable because they lack language, they lack connection with other people, there's no safety harness for them. And so in that situation then, the entirety of their control is given to is in someone else's hands. So, for example, in Eastern Europe where we live, you have men, 40 and 50 year old men, who end up going to Germany or to Holland, to Belgium, to work on farms. Now, they may voluntarily make that decision to go work on that farm because their family is hungry and they need to provide. When they get into that situation, their documents are gone, they don't speak the language, and from the get-go, they have already, as soon as they leave their home country, they're racking up, their controllers are racking up all the expenses that they now owe. So by the time that person from Bulgaria ends up in Belgium, they already owe €1,000 to the person who got them there, to the trafficker. And so you have people, grown men, in horrible conditions, without any means of release or escape, and now in debt to the very person who has trafficked them. And in a worse situation than when they left. And they left as a means of helping their families.
I was just going to say, when you're talking about this, I'm in an area right now with the largest Hispanic population,
yeah.
Spanish speaking. And I think about my people in the church we just started, a Spanish speaking congregation, who say, you know, we make nothing. I mean, we're talking like nothing. And this is in East Tennessee. And you can ask, well, why don't you demand minimum wage? Can't do that. Well, why don't you go to an attorney?
Can't do that.
You go to an attorney to get your legal citizenship, and they charge you, and then you find out 8 months later that you're $5,000 in debt for court costs.
Yeah.
They never did anything.
Yeah.
And there are no rights. There are no privileges. They're devalued as human beings.
Yeah.
And that's in the U.S. because forced here, supporting families who live in Guatemala or Mexico or somewhere, come here to work. So, I mean, even, and as you mentioned, just noticing that struck a powerful chord with me, just noticing vulnerability.
Mm-hmm.
And it's complicated because even not just women, I'm thinking women in my community, I know that they're vulnerable, but men like who speak Spanish and they're in this situation. And I even said to him, I said, I think it would make a difference if I went to you to your workplace. He makes pallets.
Mm-hmm.
He said, no, because if you go and you call attention to it,
yeah.
and the cops come out, and they find out that I'm not fully a legal citizen, I'm kicked out. And all my children are here, they're legal citizens because they're born here. So what happens if, say, it's just so complicated.
It's so complicated.
This gentleman has told me, this brother in Christ has told me, just us just knowing.
Mm-hmm.
Just sort of in solidarity saying, man, you know, I know you're going through that, and if I can do anything, you know, looking for ways, praying, and, you know, that makes a bit of a difference, but it's frustrating, you know, you kind of tug and pull and go, oh, is there an answer to this?
I think part of it, you know, we know from Wesley that he promoted this idea that as you become involved, as you know, as you learn, as you feel, as you become emotionally connected and relationally connected to the poor, that out of that then comes the intensity to help. And also the knowledge, to exegete, right? To understand, to learn. And this is a Holy Spirit activity. It's not just me against the traffickers with the person who is vulnerable, but the Holy Spirit is a part of this. And this is how the Holy Spirit works. This is His job, to lead us and to make a way. I mean, Scripture promises us that God will make a way. But to stand outside and to look through the windows and say, oh, yeah, awareness by itself is impotent.
You had made the statement earlier. You said that there are those who look to the West and see the American dream with the incredible education of it. And, you know, I think of, you know, the stories just from the last few weeks of thousands, if not tens of thousands, of refugees from Ethiopia and Somalia that are now flooding into Greece, which is broken in its own right, financially and in other ways, and into Italy, and then are flooding into different parts of Europe because of famine of opportunity, using that same language. And then once they get there, listening to some of the interviews that I've heard on the radio of, we'll take anything at this point.
Yeah.
Because, you know, they're living in tent cities and are sneaking out of tent cities in the nighttime to try to find other places across the globe to run to.
Yeah.
But it still beats where they came from.
Yeah.
In the midst of making opportunity, is there, because I agree 100% that there is that first step, and probably the most important step is, do we see the other with dignity and with the fullness of humanity? Mm-hmm. But is there also an extent where the discipline of simplicity plays into this as well? Because I think our gluttony, not only of food, but our gluttony of consumption of everything,
We never let anything wear out.
Yeah.
We have this addiction that says that in order to ever enjoy something, I have to possess something, which
yeah.
I think also plays into the addiction
yeah.
of the sexual trafficking. Mm-hmm. We have to own a thing to ever enjoy a thing. We
yeah.
can't just see a flower without picking it.
Yeah.
Mentality.
Yeah.
Does that simplicity play
yeah.
a role in this?
Yeah. Yeah, I think so. I do think so. I think so. When we talk about very practical things to do, I mean, I think we need to be preaching from the pulpit. We're going to have a lot of conversations about what the Supreme Court, the decisions that the Supreme Court made last week about the homosexuality issue, but how many sermons are we going to have from the pulpit about gluttony? And my point would be, not that we don't need to talk about the homosexuality decision, same-sex marriage decision. My point being, we need to talk about the sin of gluttony. And that's true. That means consumption in many different forms as a Western culture.
One of the ways that we found, just on a local setting, and I know it's a small thing, but it helps, sort of flipping the power back
mm-hmm.
around,
mm-hmm.
is we've partnered with Laney Ministries
mm-hmm.
in the city where we're at. The area where our church is located, where I'm privileged to serve, is there's a very high population of individuals who are undocumented. And
mm-hmm.
since they're undocumented, cannot go to typical food banks
right.
because of the requirements of typical food
right.
banks, IDs and things that are going along those lines. And so by partnering with cleaning organizations, and we're literally grabbing the food before it goes in a dumpster
yeah.
anyway. But it's kind of neat because the places that we glean from are places like Costco and places
yeah.
like Sam's Club and places like Walmart, who grab the food before it's going in the dumpster. And we're doing anywhere from, you know, some weeks there's no guarantee, but you know, some weeks it's 200 pounds of produce, some weeks
yeah.
it's 11 to 1700 pounds of produce.
It's amazing. It's huge.
You know, it's also putting it back in the hands of individuals, and it's produce, so it's actually food that
yeah.
normally, if you're strapped and you're not, you're buying, okay, am I going to eat it all?
Right.
Fresh greens is not exactly your first choice.
Yeah.
Anyway. So
yeah.
It's those little things that flip power back around.
Yeah. Beautiful paradigm.
I think France just illegalized
yeah.
throwing away food.
Yeah, they did.
But yeah, you're not allowed to throw away.
Edible food, consumable food, it's illegal to throw it away.
I
which is incredible.
In
France.
Not,
mm-hmm.
I mean, not
last month, I think, or
yeah,
2 months ago.
Not on a household level, like on a
corporate level.
Yeah.
If you, as you leave today, I hope that you carry with you this idea of a paradigm shift. That's the practical part that I want you to leave with. To begin to think about network. How do we network with other people? How do we become aware of vulnerability? How do we harness the gifts and talents as a congregation that God has given to us and use those things to break the cycle of vulnerability in the parish, the place where God has planted us? Very powerfully expressed today through Kathy Mowry. I shed more than one tear as I listened to hers.